This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen.
What the hell just happened?
To the lovely, luxurious, and very clean L-shaped studios in Ho Ho Loon Plaza, Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. We have kicked out all visitors from the premises. Our new butler, Ho Ho Loon, who signed on just a few weeks ago, has cleaned the area. And we are ready for a brand new episode of the longest-running weekly
episodic comic book podcast
in all of Place to Be Nation.
I apologize for giggling there in the middle of it, missing my cue. It's just, out of the corner of my ear, I could hear off over in a secluded area of the L-shaped studios, I could hear Mr. Ross, warming up for his appearance coming up at the end of the show, and we'll leave that to the listener's imagination right now.
We got to ask ourselves some hard questions here, Nick. I mean, how are we going to afford to keep flying Jim Ross from Oklahoma all the way to Vancouver every week?
Well,
and you paying for our new butler, Ho Ho Loon?
Well, first of all, we're paying Ho Ho Loon in whatever the currency of Hong Kong is. So that's, that exchange rate, we're doing pretty decent on that. Second of all, JR actually is up here learning mysterious barbecue techniques from the Inuit people. I don't actually know if there are Inuit people here in Vancouver, but I'm going to assume that there are. And it's got the nice comics tie because Tom Kalmaku was an Inuit, so there you are.
Yes. What was his given nickname again, Nick?
Pieface.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And we also, while we're talking about different people from around the globe, we also want to throw a shout out to our New Zealand listeners.
Yes.
Big fans of the show, mm-hmm. I know, from the earliest days of our podcast, Nick. Mm-hmm.
They really are. We're big in New Zealand, and by big I mean we are virtually non-existent in New Zealand.
Well, speaking of virtually non-existent, let's talk about our excitement for tonight's episode.
Oh my god.
Because that's right, folks, Walking Dead month lives on. It must live on.
It sure does.
For it is October, and every year here at the Hard Traveling Studios, we take on The Walking Dead. And so far this month, we've had what I think has been one of our best Walking Dead months to date, Nick. We've had a great guest in Jennifer Smith come on and talk a little bit about the best episodes of the television show The Walking Dead. We had an occasion to review the season premiere of this year, The Walking Dead. We even last week got a chance to talk about our love of the Walking Dead video games from Telltale Studios. But unfortunately, we have to close out Walking Dead month on a bit of a down note. In fact, not just a bit of a down note, Nick, but a rather infuriatingly down note. So we are here to bring you an episode of The Long Book Hunters, where we take a look at the world of trade paperback collections and graphic novels. And we're here to talk to you about the fourth collected edition of The Walking Dead by Robert Kirkman and Charlie Adler. And, of course, the subtitle for this book is, as everyone knows, The Heart's Desire.
The Heart's Desire. And my heart's desire is to never read this fucking god-awful comic ever again. So,
absolutely.
At this point, I am hoping that the show will be canceled at the conclusion of this season so that Walking Dead month can go away. Because as long as the show is on the air, we will continue doing Walking Dead month, which means I have to keep reading this god-awful comic book. We did this last year, and I'm sorry, but if you like this comic book, please explain to me why. What about it is it that you like? It's not well written. The art is terrible now that they've we're full into the Charlie Adler era instead of who was it, Tony Moore that started the series, Greg?
Tony Moore.
Tony Moore art is pretty good in the first volume. I will grant you that. It's the one saving grace of the book. There is no saving grace after that, and this volume continues that tradition of suck.
Yes, this collects The Walking Dead number 19 through 24, released from June to November of 2005, so well before the television show was launched, which I am really, really, really genuinely, folks, struggling to understand the popularity of this. This book, not the show, not the concept, but this particular comic book, because other than the fact that characters walk around dropping the F word like it's a transition as like the or as or something, other than the fact that there's fuck in every other sentence and obscene violence, which who doesn't love all of that stuff, there's really – I don't even see what would appeal to someone about this because and granted, everybody's got different tastes, so certainly I'm not going to be a cultural – snob here and say, hey, you know what, my tastes are better than yours, but from a writing and a story standpoint, this thing is just it was such a frustrating reading experience. You guys know it's been a running joke on the show as of late about how slow I read things. Right? Do you know how long it took me to read this?
How long is that?
Let's see. Combined, if I'm putting all my reading sessions together, a combined 2 hours to read the entire thing.
Man. Took me about 35 minutes.
Yep. And you might think, wow, that's awesome. It read really fast. That means it's entertaining for Nick and Greg. No.
No.
No. It just means that there's nothing interesting going on at all.
There was not a single thing that made me stop and go, huh, look at that. I just kept reading and kept waiting for there to be some sort of plot or, you know, character development or interesting occurrence of any kind on these pages. And no, 130 pages of nothing.
It's, I believe, what Tim Capel would refer to as doo-doo shit.
Doo-doo shit, yes. Doo-doo shit, I believe.
Doo-doo shit.
Yes, is the term.
I heard that term for the first time from Leroy McGurk.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking of Leroy McGurk, he had an incident involving his crotch, and so does Tyrese in this story, Nick.
Oh, God. Yes, he does. Tyrese and Michonne have an incident involving Tyrese's crotch. Listen.
Listen. Now, I understand.
There are certain individuals out there who will claim that, you know, this comic is better than the television show, but that's not what I'm seeing here on the field.
I mean, I wouldn't want anyone to blow their opportunity at making their point.
No, my point is, all these people who are so upset that the comic or that the television show isn't just like the comic,
mm-hmm.
I think you could pick any number of reasons why the television show is better than the comic. But for this volume, we'll focus in on the character of Michonne, who, let's remember, I have not always been a great fan of hers on the show as it stands. I've been very critical of her at times, and I'm not really a believer in Michonne or any of that other bullshit they've done on the show over the last couple of years. But I will say this, at the very least, they do a good job of developing her character, making her have agency, making her be independent. And here in the comic, within 30 pages of her first appearance, they go out of the way to sexualize her, and like,
mm-hmm.
You know, it's just unnecessary. Like, it just doesn't make any sense for her character.
She's introduced in this book as a loner walking around with her pet zombies. The pet zombies are discarded within probably 8-9 panels of her appearance with regards to her actual character being shown on the pages. They're gone quickly. She disperses of her sword because she has to turn it in as part of the contingency of joining the prison here with the rest of the gang. And then she goes around and she literally, for the first time meeting Tyrese, she meets him, finds out he played for the Falcons, and then in the next scene where they're together, she walks to Tyrese, who's in a committed relationship, and gives him a blowjob on the basketball court. Seemingly against his will.
Yes. She just...
And then he's just like, oh, all right.
Well, I guess that happened. Yep.
Yep. Then he tells her later on that he's not interested in having a relationship with her, that he broke up because he had just broken up with Carol, and she forces herself on him and begins making out with him, and then suddenly they're an item.
Yeah, I mean, Carol breaks up with him because she sees, you know, Tyrese receiving this unsolicited blowjob from Michonne that causes all kinds of hell. And this leads to issues between, all of a sudden, Rick, of course, being... Well, this makes sense, actually. Rick, being the fine, upstanding, moral citizen that he is, he gets to determine what is right for everyone in the prison. And so when he finds out that Tyrese and Carol have broken up because Tyrese, you know, got a blowjob from Michonne, Rick... is well within his rights to come down on Tyrese, to be the moral voice of authority, to accuse Tyrese of breaking someone's poor heart in the middle of the zombie apocalypse and all these other things going on and causing issues within the group. And how dare Tyrese do any of this? And Rick is just, again, within his rights to do this.
He's shouting it all. You can see the veins popping from his forehead and his neck.
Yes.
Entire panels, Nick, filled with word balloons with like 18-point font, jagged with exclamation points at the end of it, saying, "Fuck you, Tyrese! You don't know what you did! Fuck you!" And then Tyrese, of course, answers, "No, fuck you! Fuck you, Rick! You don't talk to me like that!" And then Rick's like, "I just fucking did!" And then they fight, and then Tyrese beats his ass.
And then Joe's doll looks like Joe.
And so Rick then is picking himself up off the ground, a bloodied mess at the hands of Tyrese, and then he still is like, "You still were in the fucking wrong. You know what you did. You might as well have cut her wrist yourself." Because you see, Carol went and tried to kill herself.
Yes.
Naturally, because she saw Michonne give a blowjob to her boyfriend. Tyrese then says, "Fuck you!" And then Rick fights Tyrese, and they fall off a balcony, and Tyrese jumps down for no adequately explained reason and breaks his own ankle. It's one of the freaking... Seriously, of all the volumes we've read of this book so far, it's the worst sequence I've ever read in any Walking Dead comic.
Just because it's so nonsensical.
No, nothing makes sense. No one's behavior makes any sense. And I know I can hear the response now. It's the zombie apocalypse. Of course people's behavior isn't making sense. That doesn't work in fiction. You have to at least have linear progression of your characters, or at least some sort of development of your characters. And this feels like people just acting randomly to fit whatever whim Robert Kirkman was on at the moment that he wrote it. Also, to your point, Nick, this dude cannot write women at all, at least in The Walking Dead.
No, he can't.
These women are pathetic figures. Every scene of a woman in The Walking Dead in this volume is women sitting around talking about the men. Everyone. Or, better than that, Nick, sitting around talking about knitting. I wish I could make that up, but no.
Yeah, it's
everyone, and that.
And how about then? Like,
all of them are dependent on the men in their lives,
right? Even to the point where there's that scene where like Rick has to not only go tell Lori to check on Carol because she's upset, but he literally tells her verbatim everything to say during the conversation. And Lori finally goes, "Yeah, I've done this a time or two before, Rick." Like, at least to his credit, he does that.
Yeah, it's. And Rick, at the one of the big culminating moments in this story is when Dale comes to Rick after he's been beaten into a coma by Tyrese, and he calmly tells Rick that he's no longer going to be the leader, and Rick's like, "Well, thank fuck for that," and then Dale says, no, "You're still a leader though. You're part of this council. We voted while you were in a coma to put you on the Council of Four to make decisions for us." And Rick, to their credit, Rick says, "Hey, why are there no women on the panel, which consists of Tyrese, Rick, Dale, and Herschel, I guess?"
And, yeah, Tyrese, Rick, Dale, and Herschel. Yeah, that's it.
And so Rick says, why aren't there any women? And of course, it turns out that the women themselves decided amongst themselves that they didn't deserve to be making any decisions for the group, that the men knew what was best.
That's absolutely insane. I don't even know what to... it makes no sense.
None of this makes any gosh dang sense. But they have Alan repeat the same lines over and over again after the useless Alan, gets bitten by a zombie and is laying in bed, eventually dies. Off panel, by the way. Dies off panel.
Yes.
And so while he's laying there in his little bed or in the jail cell or whatever, when he's first bitten, he tells Rick, "Take care of my boys. Look after them like they're your own." Then his next scene, he tells the exact same thing to Andrea, I think it is, that's looking over him. "Look after my boys like they were your own." You know, it's like the writing is just so inconsistent. There's typos. There's it's none of it's good. What about the transitions, Nick? We haven't talked about the
transitions. What transitions?
Because there aren't any.
There are none. There never are any. Like, it just, you know.
You will have an abrupt ending of a scene, and then the next page will be something that is some inordinate amount of time later, and there's no way to determine how much time has passed.
I don't know.
For instance, here's a scene I'm scrolling through right now on Hoopla. So Herschel is out gardening with. Herschel is trying to help Rick. Along with Axel, not good Axel, but shitty comic book Axel, trying to help them cut off the blood supply on Alan's wounded leg after it's been amputated by Rick in a bizarre scene. And then we cut to a little sojourn with Carl and Sophia, I guess is who that is, looking at zombies. They turn their heads. And they see them carrying Alan through the door. Next page is Otis randomly praying in a chapel or something and getting upset because he's being bossed around by Tyrese. And as established randomly early in the issue, he's a racist. Even though we've been made to root for him this entire time, he's actually secretly a racist.
Unbelievable. Just
next page, we get Lori and Carol sitting here talking. And then the next page, we get Rick telling her about it. And then a couple pages, I'm trying to get to the transition. Okay, so we're watching Alan suffer and Carol find out about Alan getting his leg amputated and all that. And suddenly the next page, Tyrese getting a blowjob. Then the next page after that, Glenn and Maggie laying post-coitus.
Okay, that's one thing. That is the only not terrible aspect of this is Glenn and Maggie.
Yes. The best scene in the entire issue, in fact, in my opinion, in the book, rather, is Glenn and Maggie's heart-to-heart with Herschel.
Yes.
When Herschel brings Maggie out and basically tells her, "Look, I know what the hell you're doing. I'm not an idiot, you know?
Yeah, you've been in the cell for 7 hours by yourself. Like, you know...
I saw those discarded Blue Chew packets on the ground.
Oh man, the Blue Chew, which is actually, by that's how they got into the cell, because the cell was locked. Glenn popped the Blue Chew and knocked a few bars out of the way, and that's how they entered into the cell.
Mm-hmm. And Maggie is very kind to Glenn, telling him that he's not got any issues in the size department.
He took a Blue Chew, of course he doesn't.
Right, that's why, yeah. So it's, this is actually a really good scene that wouldn't have felt out of place on the TV show at all.
Yeah, no, this was good. This was the one good scene in 134 goddamn pages.
And what about this boring, then they go from that to the most boring scene where Rick tries to make a fist for an entire page.
Yes, because Tyrese knocked him off the scaffold, now like he can't make a fist or something stupid like that. Oh, God, so stupid.
Oh, Lord. And then Carol tries to make out with Rick, because of course she does, because she's a woman in The Walking Dead. And Rick has to tell her, "Look, I know I'm the best man in the world, and I know I'm a good lover and husband and father, but... I'm not the last man on earth. There's other men out there for you, Carol."
You know. What? Carol only tried to fuck Rick because Rick didn't like Tyrese. I mean, that's what this comic does to its female characters. She's going to get back at Tyrese by fucking the dude he just had a fight with. You know, I have nothing.
This dialogue is so awful. So much exposition of talking about, you know, in random conversations. You know, back when we took the caravan down the road and we were attacked by zombies, and then we got back in the caravan and we came here to the prison where we all live right now in different cell blocks. What? And then the other thing. How do these living arrangements work? Because I swear to God, Nick, I'm sitting here reading it the other night, and I'm like, they're talking about what they wake up Carol because they're I think it's Carol, it might be Andrea, I can't tell because all the characters look the same. Because they're unwrapping Rick's bandage. Herschel's unwrapping Rick's bandage inside a cell. So like, are Rick and Carol staying in the same cell together? I don't know. I can't tell. Are Herschel and Carol, do they sell together? I just can't tell with this book, Nick. And it's not helped by the fact that every white dude in this comic looks exactly the same as the other.
Otis and Herschel might as well be twins, for all I care.
They have the same, like, general, like, 5 o'clock shadow and slick black hair look. And, you know, I mean, Rick doesn't look that much different from them. And then the women, the only thing separating the women in appearance, other than, like, the darkness of Lori's hair, I guess, is some of them have dots on their face to represent freckles.
Nothing.
What's going on?
All I'm saying... Oh, boy. All I'm saying is that when you pronounce the word darkness now, you can't help but say it to a certain voice. You didn't even do it on purpose.
It's kind of like you with listen now.
I guess. Ooh.
Anyway, I don't know if we've been clear enough about how bad this book is. I know that there's going to be fans of this book, too, Nick, that are going to listen to this and be upset with us for not liking it, but I can't help it. I tried. I want it. It's not like I don't want to like this. I read it. I read the whole thing. I took my Sunday away from football, and I read The Walking Dead.
Yeah.
And I just don't get it, I guess, is what it comes down to.
I will never – you know,
there's not a single character in this book that I liked.
And people
– okay, Glenn and Maggie, they're okay.
And I keep hearing the same thing. You just have to let it – you have to let it build. It picks up eventually. And I'm like, how many fucking issues do I have to pour into this? You know?
I can't believe it. I can't believe that it picks up because Nick, at this point, there's no way that I'm ever going to have any emotional attachment to any of these characters. Just none. I do not care. Rick could be beheaded in the next chapter, and I would not care. I wouldn't blink an eye. I'd say, "Oh well, that happened."
This you book, like my only hope, because I got before, when I tried to read it like five or six years ago, I got pretty deep into it. My only hope is that next year brings us the governor. Because at least there will be something happening. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Because
now... there will be a character with some...
These people import. Are just walking around the prison bitching at one another. Yes. And I don't care about any of them, so I don't take sides. So it's just like, what is the point here?
Because they don't seem like real people. They seem like... what?
Bad caricatures. Bad
caricatures of people.
And they're badly drawn, like you said.
Rick's a good man pushed to the brink.
Yes.
Tyrese is a good man pushed to the brink.
Yes.
Herschel is a troubled older man who is struggling to adjust to the new world.
Dale is a troubled older man who is struggling to adjust to the new world. But he's catching him some young pussy, so he's feeling pretty good about himself.
Yes, yes.
Blue Dale is alive and well in cell block Dale.
That's actually how they found the leftover Blue Chews. Dale's been using them.
Been hiding them all in his eyebrows.
I don't know. This version of Axel has some impressive eyebrows as well.
This version of Axel has that beard. My God.
This version of Axel looks like Volstagg.
This version of Axel looks like what I imagine Bray Wyatt will look like in like 30 years.
Yes. Which he'll be pounding that younger individual probably at that point. What I'm getting at is there's a large age difference between Bray Wyatt and Grand Grin.
Well, not that large. Can't be.
I guess, yeah, 10 years, something like that.
10 years, you know.
Not as significant as Dale and Andrea.
No.
Andrea is drawn to look like she's about 19.
Mm-hmm.
Dale is drawn to look like he's about 65.
65? And that bucket hat, and he is getting it in, man. Good for him.
Oh, shit. Nick, are you still there?
I'm still here.
Studio. I almost ruined everything right now.
What the hell's going on?
This is phenomenal.
What are you doing? Hello? What the fuck is happening?
Which is appropriate for this disastrous book.
What the hell just happened?
Well, I nearly disconnected my headset on accident.
It sounds like you did disconnect your headset.
Anyway.
Alright. Well.
So, Nick, your thoughts on The Walking Dead Volume 4?
It sucked, and you're a bad person if you like it.
You know, normally I would be the good cop here, and I would say, you know, that's a bit harsh, what Nick just did there. But in this case, I may be tempted to agree with him, because, man, this was not good. This was not, like, even stuff that we've not liked in the past, the stuff that we agree on not liking, I can usually say, well, you know, it's got its audience, I get it, you know. And I love so much of the outside media of The Walking Dead, TV show, games, etc. But I just don't get it, and I've never gotten it. This is not like hindsight saying this. I remember when Walking Dead first became a TV show, I decided to check out the comic books and try it, and I didn't get it at all. And so, like, I don't know, man. Maybe, like, if I don't know. Maybe it's like an introductory thing to comics. I don't know. Maybe, maybe if they introduce, like, a reanimated, I don't know, Blackjack Mulligan or something in it.
Or a reanimated Klondike Bill.
Oh, certainly. I would buy that, certainly. But then, even then, they probably wouldn't get Klondike's character right.
No, they probably wouldn't. They would have him just show up, and instead of chewing panties or sitting under glass tables, he would just tell Rick how great he is.
How great he is. And then he'd give Michonne a $5 bill to take a shit on him.
And she'd do it, gladly.
She'd do it.
Oh, God.
Oh,
I have nothing. I have
one thing here is that they talk about Tyrese playing for the Atlanta Falcons in 1998.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I got to tell you, Nick, that was a successful year for the Falcons. So you would think that Tyrese wouldn't have had such a short NFL career had he indeed played for the 1998 Falcons.
Well, I mean, he may have been a depth player, really been a featured role on the 1998 Super Bowl team.
He wouldn't have been a Terrence Mathis, sir.
No, no Terrence Mathis, no Tony Martin, no Jesse Tuggle, no Chuck Smith.
Jamal Anderson.
No Lester Archambault.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Lester Archambault.
Yeah. Like that, don't you?
Good Lord. All right. Well, with Lester Archambault, I feel bad, Nick, because we haven't talked very long, but, like,
No,
I don't know what else to say about this. Like,
it sucks, and you're a bad person if you like it.
I guess we should explain to people who maybe only follow The Walking Dead comics through our show, if there is anyone like mm-hmm. that. The plot here is that nothing happens. They're in the prison, and they're setting up shop, and the existing prisoners try to stage a coup and turn on Rick and company to force them out. But then these the walkers come in and attack them.
That's it.
And Rick ends up shooting the leader of this rebellion group and then lying about it, which leads to some stuff later on. Although, again, the overarching theme of – even though Rick does a lot of questionable shit in this comic, the overarching theme by the end of his overwrought monologue is that he's the only one that's encouraged to make the right decisions for the group. And then they all just stand there befuddled looking at him as if they're contemplating what he's saying. And I'm certain, I haven't read it yet, but I'm certain Volume 5, Nick, when we get to it, will feature the follow-up to that scene where Rick dramatically proclaims that, "We are the Walking Dead!" The next scene's going to be everyone saying, "You know what, Rick, you're right. We're going to make you leader again, and we're going to line up, and we're going to suck you off, too." It's not good. And so that's just That happens. They stay in prison. You know, we already talked about Alan getting bitten and eventually killed. Carol slits her wrist but doesn't die. Dale sits around telling Rick how great he is. Lori talks about knitting with Andrea. I mean, there's just nothing of import. Michonne arrives and talks to a fictitious person in her cell, which might be interesting if not for Michonne being horrible and completely not interesting as a character. There's just nothing going on here, Nick.
No, I have nothing.
It would defeat my love of comics if this were the primary comic I were pulling right now. I'll put it this way, Nick. I am more likely to, outside of this show, of my own free will, purchase and read the entirety of Tom King's Batman run than I ever am to read for fun an issue of this series.
Here's the difference between that and this. Tom King's Batman run, I think you can at least acknowledge, is competently written and drawn.
Yes.
And you take issue with the characterizations and the creative direction of the story.
That's correct.
There's nothing competent about this comic book in any respect.
No, I mean, the thing is, I've heard so many good things about Invincible, which is Robert Kirkman's other most prominent comic book title, but nothing about this writing makes me want to give Invincible a shot because I just have a hard time believing that it would be any good.
Right.
Because I've had to read on forums for years, on Facebook, on Twitter, people complaining and bitching and moaning to the producers of AMC's The Walking Dead about doing things different from the comics and how horrible they are for killing off Carl and how horrible they are for when people thought they had killed off Glenn differently from the comic and how terrible it was when they veered from the comic book storyline. And as I read this, I think to myself that even the decisions they've made that I haven't agreed with on the show have been better than what I'm seeing here.
Yeah, I agree with all of that.
Credit to Robert Kirkman for coming up with the concept, but sometimes a concept is created and taken beyond what it begins as and done, and people improve on it and tinker with it until it works, and that's the case here. You guys have encountered that in Marvel Age.
Yes.
Some ideas are not in their founding what they would become later on that makes them successful.
Absolutely. I agree with everything you just said. The issue is that here, this is beyond the founding. Like we are a good 25 mm-hmm. issues into this book, and there's nothing.
Yes,
there's just nothing.
I make this argument all the time. It's like I know that not everything is going to succeed right out of the gate, but you only get so much time.
You only get so much leeway.
Yeah, it's like a lot of shows struggle with their first season. Gotham's first season was really bad. I picked up season 3, I think, and tried to watch a few episodes of it and didn't like it then either. So, you know, it's you only have so much. I went through it with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. I've heard it's much better now, but like once you've burned me for 2.5-3 seasons, it's like, you know, you've lost me.
Yeah. I mean,
That's all we're going to say about that.
It's not even, like, this volume, unlike 2 and 3, wasn't even, like, the entertaining kind of bad where that I could tear it apart. It was just boring as hell, and I feel to waste any more oxygen on discussing this piece of shit is a disservice to our own personal lives and well-being.
You said it perfect, Bubba. So, with that being said, let us hear it. If you want to take us to task, for whatever reason, let us hear it. Let us hear your reasons why you like this comic book, or why you hate the comic book, or why you just are indifferent towards it. Send us your feedback on Twitter. I am at gphillips8652. He is at nickduke87. Send us emails, gregp@placetobenation.com, nickd@placetobenation.com. Find us on the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page. Mm-hmm. Just type in Place to Be Nation Comics on Facebook. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you can find us PTBN Pop on Twitter.
PTBN Comics.
And PTBN Comics. God dang it. I'm doing it every week, Nick. Every freaking week. It's PTBN Comics. Forget PTBN Pop. Although, you can catch our PTBN Pop Facebook page by typing in PTBN Pop mm-hmm. and finding it there.
And don't forget to go out to PlaceToBeNation.com and look up the third biennial Peter David Memorial Place to Be Nation Pop Fantasy Comics Draft presented by a hypothetical, non-rotational DC Comics online unlimited subscription service, Pitches.
That's right. Check out the Pitches. Read the instructions. Be sure to scroll through all six pages. Mm-hmm. There has been some confusion of people that hadn't seen the little things at the bottom. Read the text at the bottom. It'll tell you exactly what to do. Six pages of Pitches. At the end of your reading of those, which it may take you a while this time, at the end of your reading those, be sure to put together a list of 12 to 15 comic book titles from these mm-hmm. fictitious universes combined that you would be interested in pulling in your monthly pull list. Cut it down to 12 to 15. Send those to Nick Duke. You can send them to nickduke.nd.
We're not giving out shoot email addresses on this podcast.
Oh, okay.
We're sending those to nickd at placetobenation.com. For God's sake, Greg.
Okay, well, Nick's social security number, if you're interested, is...
12. Anyway. It's 12.
It's 12, yes. Actually, that's Jeremy Reynolds' social security number.
Hey-o, count it.
Just kidding, Jeremy. Anyway, that's it. So send us your feedback. Let us know what you think. Walking Dead, Place to Be Nation,
actually,
comic book pitch.
Actually, if you like it, don't send us your feedback because we don't really care. So
yes,
you know,
but we do. Keep it however, if you do like it and you send us your feedback, we will care as long as you submit pitches mm-hmm. Or your pull list.
Yeah.
To Nick D at PlaceToBeNation.com.
That's it.
Now, we're going to take a break, regroup our senses here, and when we come back, we've got all the stuff you know about from us.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com, and we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, Main Event, Survey Says, Wrestling War Zone, a Monday Night Wars podcast retrospective, No Holds Barred, Jeff Learns Wrestling, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. On top of that, we're also dipping into the vault, re-releasing the entire catalog of Where the Big Boys Play for your enjoyment. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is loaded with great content, offering such tremendous shows covering the land of pop culture, such as Geek and Sassy, Talkin' Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Sunday Groove, PTB In Play, Freak Out Drive-In, Songs with Friends, Looking Forward, Looking Back, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Conversation Comics, DC Post Crisis Management, Marvel Age, and Marvel Age Masterclass, plus weekly pod blasts that cover the gamut of comic topics. The feed is also filled with insightful sports content, including the NBA team, This Week in the NFL, and more.
And you can find all these current shows, plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well, by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available at PlaceToBeNation.com. We cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon while doing your online shopping. And download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebook via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Folks, if you thought that it was going to be less of a train wreck in the back half, you were wrong. Good Lord. What are we doing?
What are we doing? Folks, we are back to the studio after our break. We actually hopped on the newly reconstructed Gus bus and got ourselves back to the studio.
Oh, we
How
did.
How was that ride, Nick? Oh, that was a fun ride.
It was great. It was great. I saw, except a guy in the back having carnal relations with a cow. It was pretty good.
I kind of enjoyed that, actually. It was educational.
It was. Now you know what that looks like.
Exactly. So we're back in the studio. The bus is back in working order to get us back to out rural Alabama after this recording session is mercifully over. But what we're going to do right now, folks, we've already talked to you about the joys of the Walking Dead comic book. What we're going to do is we're going to move on to our weekly look at news and notes in the world of comics. Listen, it's time for the rundown.
Welcome to the rundown.
Our first story on the rundown is Luke Cage.
Indeed.
Luke Cage has been canceled by Netflix. The television series, Marvel's Luke Cage, Luke. And the rumors, not allegations, the rumors are flying about the reason behind the cancellation. Obviously, Iron Fist has already been canceled before Luke Cage was canceled. And we talked about that a little bit, that it was, you know, probably a deserved cancellation after right. just not getting any momentum out of the gate from the first season. However, Luke Cage is one that still had some buzz behind it. Granted, season two much less so than season one. But apparently there was a creative disagreement between Marvel Television and Netflix. Netflix was either unhappy with the scripts that were submitted or something else. There have been rising tensions, and it all went distinctly south over the course of 2 days. Netflix requested new writers for the show. And one of the hot rumors flying around on some of the online forums, Twitter and elsewhere, is that Netflix requested a cut down to 10 episodes and that they met with resistance from Marvel Television on that request. So, Nick, you're more in tune with the Marvel Netflix universe than I am on account of I'm behind on so many of these shows. What are your thoughts on this announcement? Did this catch you off guard? Did you see it coming? And what do you think it means for the future?
No, this caught me completely off guard. The Iron Fist thing...
Sorry, folks. Off camera. We're getting in the weeds right now, folks.
The Iron Fist thing a couple weeks ago made some level of sense, like, because it was both critically and, you know, fan-wise derived. I mean, like, people hated it. There was very little momentum for that show. I heard the second season was better, but it never really found its audience. It never really found that fan base. Luke Cage, however, was completely the opposite. It was critically beloved. It had found... What I would say is probably, and I don't, you know, Netflix doesn't release numbers, so it's hard to know this, but it seems to me like it had found a, not small, but a medium-sized fan base that was very passionate about the show because of, you know, the obvious issues with lack of representation, minorities, and superhero properties that, you know, even despite the success of Black Panther, is still something of an issue.
And they were expressing their support at a medium pace.
At a medium pace, right. So... This caught me completely off guard just because I did not see a black-led, black-written... This show was produced almost entirely by the black community, and Netflix pulled the plug on it in today's political environment, which is weird to me. Like, I'm not saying you have to make all your creative decisions based off, you know, political reasons, but I would not have made this move. I would not have wanted to risk alienating a segment of your subscriber base. This was just weird to me. You know, nothing, I haven't finished Luke Cage season 2 yet, but I'm almost to the end, and nothing that's happened in season 2 makes me feel like it was in need of some drastic creative shakeup that's been rumored. It's been a fine season. Nothing great, nothing to the highs of season 1 of Luke Cage, but certainly nothing to the lows of the back half of season 1 of Luke Cage. It's been the most consistently decent Netflix show, I think is the best way I can put it. Like, it's never really gotten to a great episode, but there haven't really been any bad ones either. So,
yeah,
I don't know. This is ultra weird to me.
Yeah, very much a surprise. And I know a lot of people are holding out hope that it might be revived on Disney's streaming service, which is a possibility, or even a Heroes for Hire show with Luke and Danny Rand. But I think the combination of the fact that Disney has talked about wanting to keep its streaming service family friendly to a degree, and then also the I just think it's more likely that they would cut ties entirely and do a different no knock on Mike Coulter, who's awesome as Luke Cage, but I could see them just wanting to do their own version of it and separate themselves entirely from the Netflix universe at this point. Do you think that's where this is all going?
I don't think so. I think that there is a possibility that this version, this character, this version of Luke Cage could continue on just in a different setting. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think that necessarily just because they began as R-rated adult-themed shows that they can't be transitioned into something more akin to what the MCU has been. Not to say that, you know, that it'll be that approach exactly, but I would really argue that the only one of the shows, the only one of these characters that can't make that change no matter what is Punisher and possibly Jessica Jones as well. Daredevil can make that swap. Iron Fist can make that swap. Luke Cage can make that swap. And I know everyone is saying that it's not in the works and they're denying it. There's still a part of me that would not be surprised if Netflix announced Heroes for Hire. Essentially merging Luke and Danny into one show.
Yeah.
I know that's unlikely. I know everybody has said that there's all kinds of bad blood, but I don't know. It feels, you know, it feels wrestling worky to me, I guess, to a certain extent. But perhaps that's just my wrestling fandom invading other parts of my life.
The interesting thing there is I sort of agree with you because Black Lightning is dealing with network restrictions right now and is really doing a lot of what Luke Cage tried to do out of the gates with kind of being a socio-political show and doing a good job of it and doing it within network restrictions. So, you know, it can be done. Whether they'll want to do it or it'll be the option will be open for them, I don't know. But we'll just have to keep an eye on that situation and monitor it and monitor the future of Marvel Netflix as an entity going forward.
Mm-hmm.
Moving on to the CW DC TV universe, we got a long-awaited report this week that probably the second most famous DC supervillain is coming to the TV screen. No, it is not the Joker. However, Lex Luthor is finally going to be making his debut on Supergirl in season 4 as a recurring character. This according to the show's executive producers, Robert Rovner and Jessica Quellner. They will be introducing Lex into Supergirl's mythology. They said they've talked about it since the inception of the show, and now they can finally have him arrive. One can only extrapolate from that, Nick, that this means that Lex will not be making any film appearances anytime soon.
Of course, you know, maybe that whole thing has been put on hold, that whole no simultaneous appearances. I don't know. It's hard to get a read.
Well, then if it is, Nick, I sure hope Deathstroke's coming back soon.
That would be awesome.
Lex is going to be coming on the show. I believe they don't have an actor cast yet. They are looking for an actor.
Is it bad that part of me wishes they would have waited until next season?
Why is that?
So they could do Crisis and just have Rosenbaum do it after the crossover.
God, that would be amazing. We were talking about that amongst ourselves in one of our chat threads, and it would be really, really cool if Rosenbaum was able to do this. But unfortunately, I doubt that's in the cards.
Do the Crisis crossover next year and use it as a way to replace Tyler with Tom Welling, and just do Tom Welling and Rosenbaum as the Superman and Lex of this universe, like officially, like merge them all into one. You know,
I'd
be down.
What a crazy world. There's so much cool stuff here going on, and I'm super pumped to see Lex on the TV screen. Lex is one of those characters again that until Jesse Eisenberg, I don't think there had ever really been a bad version of Lex on screen.
Yeah, I mean the Hackman one is.
I mean, look, it's not the version of the kid we prefer to see,
right?
But it was entertaining.
It was entertaining, right? Yeah. It's kind of like the I'll give you that. Fair enough.
And then I think TV TV in particular, and then even Kevin Spacey was just doing an impression of Hackman, right. And he was really entertaining.
And he at least had the line about showing the old woman pleasures.
Right. He had some good deadpan stuff in Superman Returns. And then the TV Lexes have been uniformly awesome, whether it be Rosenbaum, whether it be John Shea on Lois Clark, or whether it be, of course, what's the guy that voiced him on Justice League?
Clancy Brown,
yes. Legendary Clancy Brown. The TV Lexes have a good reputation. Let's hope that they cast somebody that can live up to that. Mm-hmm. Well, somebody that is living up to his own reputation.
This is really cool, man.
Is former Flash star John Wesley Shipp. Of course, he has been on the CW Flash, mm-hmm. portraying Barry Allen's father and also portraying the Earth 2 speedster Jay Garrick. Mm-hmm. Well, in a leaked by Stephen Amell photo from the set of the upcoming Elseworlds crossover on the CW, which will include Arrow, The Flash, Supergirl, and the introduction of Batwoman, we have gotten the first official image of John Wesley Shipp as the 1990 Flash that he played, yes. on CBS back in the day.
Presumably a version of Barry Allen, an alternate universe version of Barry Allen, was really freaking cool.
It's awesome. Yes. I mean, it seems as if they're going to be taking him from the timeline as it looks like the same suit. It's amazing.
It looks similar to the suit, but obviously better, like updated and using mm-hmm. modern technology and materials and fabrics to make it look not so cushioned, I guess. Because that early 90s Flash costume, like, it's pretty brutal. Let's all be honest, but.
Well, they did the best they could with it.
This is like a nice merge between that design and kind of what they have Barry in on the current show right now. So this
right.
is
to me, it looks better than what Stephen Amell wearing the Flash costume, which we're also seeing in this image.
Yes, and Grant Gustin wearing the Arrow hood,
so the Green Arrow costume. Yeah,
yeah, this is awesome, man.
It's going to be great. Yes, I can't wait for this crossover. We'll talk more about the CW seasons in a moment, but I'm really excited about where they're all heading towards this. Toward this crossover, presumably.
Mm-hmm.
Now, on to the next item, which is a delay over here in the... what's this part of the office called, Nick?
We don't even know anymore. The Worlds of DC Corner?
I think so. Some of our fans may prefer to remember it as the DCEU Corner. We have one update in that regard this week, and that is that Wonder Woman 1984 has been pushed from November 1st, 2019, all the way to June 5th, 2020. I got to be honest with you, Nick. I don't think this is a big deal.
No,
and
apparently,
it's worth talking about,
apparently this was the original release date for it anyway, and then they moved it up. Now they're moving it back. I don't, Greg. I'll be honest with you. I didn't actually read this story. Is there a reason given?
Gal Gadot didn't give specifics, but just said that it was thanks to the changing landscape and is allowing them to put Wonder Woman back in its rightful home.
Okay. Not a big deal at all. I mean, like, I'm a little bummed it's not going to be here sooner, because I think it's, you know, of the DC projects that are actively in development and that we are reasonably sure is going to happen, which,
right.
for the record, there's only four of those in my mind, which right. is Joaquin Phoenix's Joker movie, for better or for worse, Shazam, Aquaman, and Wonder Woman 2. Of those four, I feel like this is the safest bet. This is the most likely to be a really damn good movie. So I'm a little bummed we're not going to get it sooner, but it's, you know, the same token, more time to work on it, more time to hammer out the things you need to get right. No issues here with me.
Agreed. Agreed completely. Well, lately on the show, you know, first of all, everybody knows what a big DC Comics fan I am. It's my preferred universe of the two. I know more about the characters. I care more about the characters overall. So I've always had a special place in my heart for the DC universe. But I've been very critical of the comic book side of DC in recent weeks on this show, particularly Batman line of comics and some of the storyline directions they're going in. Well, DC Comics has seemingly pissed off some other people as well, because it was announced this week that the Benson sisters, who wrote Batgirl and the Birds of Prey in Rebirth, and now they are they have been on a run, recently started a run on Green Arrow that was seemingly well received by Green Arrow fans and critics alike. They abruptly announced this week that they are off the title already. They said that they still had plenty of stories to tell about Oliver and his crew, but DC Comics wants to go in a different creative direction. And so the Benson sisters are out, and they are being replaced by writers Jackson Lansing and Colin Kelly. Of course, the Bensons handled it with class. They accepted their the change and credited the artist Javier Fernandez, who is an excellent artist. But now, as a result of this change, the Bensons are taking a hiatus from comic books entirely to focus on TV writing. Nick, this I haven't been reading the book, so I'm not really qualified to talk about it. But this feels a real shame that not that you know anybody's entitled to a multi-year run on a book, but that this experience was such that the Bensons aren't even going to be making comics now.
Yeah, this feels a lot like what happened to Ben Percy. Like, I don't think he is taking it as badly as they clearly are. But Ben Percy was pulled off of Nightwing for, quote, creative reasons. You know, creative differences. The good old cash or creative. The other C.
The two C. Yeah. Generally in this business, it is about one of the two C's. Cash or creative.
Yeah, in this case, about creative. What this does for me as a Green Arrow fan is it makes me nervous as hell, I'll put it that way, because if Ben Percy is the example that we're going to, the comparison we're going to use, I am very concerned about what this portends for the future of Oliver Queen as a character in the Dan Didio DC universe, because...
Think he's going to get hit with a stray arrow to the head?
I don't know. Maybe a stray arrow to the head. Maybe he gets castrated. Like I don't really know what their plans are. I guarantee you this, and this is I say this without joking. I would be stunned if 6 months from now the Oliver Queen Black Canary thing is still a thing.
Yeah.
That's going away. Like it's going to go away instantly. I would imagine, which is stupid.
It's clear who's got the power right now again in DC.
And again, I say this every time, but like. As excited as I am for more Geoff Johns writing comics, I'm starting to wish he had never left his position as a CEO because he was the only person, you know, defending the wall against freaking Dan Didio, and now here we are. And DC, with all the other changes they've gone through at Warner Brothers and everything else, I feel like nobody's even overseeing Didio, and Didio's just over there doing a bunch of dumb shit that nobody likes. You know, Rebirth, the promise of Rebirth from 3 years ago that had everybody so excited, that feels like it's gone. I'm not saying there aren't good comics out there still. Like,
sure,
I love the Tom King Batman, and you and I can agree to disagree on that.
Yeah.
You know, Brian Michael Bendis has come in, and while I hadn't read any of his books yet, I'm planning on getting to him at some point. You know, there are things going...
They've been well-received.
Right, there are things
Justice
going on...
Justice League is doing really well with Scott Snyder and company.
Right, there are things going on that interest me, but the universe, to me right now, feels more akin to the late-stage New 52 than it does to that Rebirth version of the universe we were all so excited about.
I would agree with that, and I'm so far behind on reading my monthly comics.
Right.
Right now, the only one that I'm really compelled to read is Doomsday Clock.
Right.
I'm still buying other titles. I'm still buying Deathstroke. I'm still buying what's left of the Green Lantern titles just to have them in my collection and eventually read. But nothing is making – I remember how excited I was during Rebirth every time to get to my stack, and now nothing is really making me feel like, gosh, I've got to read that. I've got to at least keep up on this. And it's not a knock necessarily on the quality of the comic. It's just the overall feeling of excitement and is a little bit gone for me right now for DC, and I think that's the case for a lot of people, you know – and really, across the board, not just isolated to DC. It's not like Marvel has any initiatives right now that are lighting the world on fire in terms of excitement. But it's just unfortunate because, you know, DC is a universe, for better or worse, is a universe that has always been built on legacy and I think the things that people like about DC characters are maybe different from the things that they like about Marvel characters. And it finally felt like DC was realizing that and getting back to that. And when you go back and you read some of these 90s events that DC had, I read like Zero Hour, I recently reread, or going back and reading like the Final Night or Day of Judgment, things like that, you do get a sense of this coherent and connected universe with literally 70 years of history, with characters going all the way back to the Golden Age who are old men now, you know, and now while Doomsday Clock is seemingly very slowly bringing that back, the overall lay of the land, it feels more scattershot than ever to me. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. And Doomsday Clock ultimately, like, with Geoff Johns no longer in a position of editorial control, you know. Yeah.
Will it even matter?
Will it even matter? Like, 2 years from now, we look at Doomsday Clock as ultimately a book that takes place outside of continuity for all intents and purposes. Not like, not saying it technically does, but I'm saying, will it matter to any sort of long-term direction for the company? Who knows? Who's to tell?
Or will it be like Alfred's reappearing hand?
How long has Dan Didio been in power at DC?
Yeah, I don't. You know, that's a great question, Nick, and I'm about to look it up because it feels like it's been 30 years.
I mean, like,
almost unprecedented at DC anyway.
Right.
Maybe not. Paul Levitz was there for a long time.
Yeah.
Paul Levitz was also awesome.
Yes, I was about to say. Hey, it's amazing this man is so not good at his job and yet keeps it.
Let's see.
2002 as vice president of editorial. He was promoted to vice president executive editor in 2004. And 2010, he was named co-publisher.
So essentially, if you go back to his time as vice president executive editor, 2004. So we're looking at, and if you let's go back to this too.
Going on 15 years.
15 years of Dan Didio in power. That's longer than Jim Shooter at Marvel.
Why? Why?
Characters.
Nobody wants to read Dick Grayson, bro.
If you just take out the dick, the character might wake. Pizza eating. Anyway.
Jonah Hex sucks because nobody wants to read a character with a southern accent.
Name me one comic book character that ever got over with a southern accent. Well, what about Gambit? Gambit doesn't have a southern accent. Gambit has a Gambit accent.
A Cajun accent. Oh, God.
What about Arn Anderson? Arn's got an on accent.
For the love of God.
And was he ever really over, Steve?
What are we doing?
What are we doing, Nick? I'll tell you what we're doing. We're reaching the end of the rundown.
Thank Christ.
And by God in heaven, we are getting longest running segment on the longest running weekly episodic comic book show on all of Place to Be Nation. We are getting to reading and watching. Boy, that was a unique delivery I had of that one.
It was. It was certainly that.
So, what you been reading, Nick?
Stop me if you've heard this before.
Is it football season?
But nothing. Nothing. I read nothing. I don't
Well, I read.
I co-host a comic book podcast, but I don't actually read comics.
Hey, that's me too.
There you go.
I read Zero Hour, A Crisis in Time, and for more of my thoughts on that, you can listen to the brand new episode of DC Post-Crisis Management, the new podcast hosted by Russell Sellers, as he stopped by our studios to discuss Zero Hour, Crisis in Time, and I learned all about Extant and Monarch and Hawk and Dove and other shit.
Mm-hmm.
It was good, actually. It was a fun time. Fun time in the studio. I think you guys will enjoy that listen, and particularly enjoy our discussion of how Parallax was right to want to destroy the universe and recreate it in his image.
Yeah.
I had no problem with it. But in any event, that's all I've been reading. So let's move on to something we've both been doing plenty of, sitting on our fat asses.
Fat asses.
And watching. So let's, I guess, do we want to get into the DC shows, CW shows?
Yeah, because I don't watch fucking Walking Dead.
All right, well, let's do the CW shows first, and then we'll get into Walking Dead, we'll get into Titans, we'll get into...
Oh, yeah, I didn't watch Titans, sorry.
And we'll get into a Slayton other thing that we watched.
We did?
So...
Oh, yeah, that. I forgot about that. Yeah, let's talk about that. That was all right.
So, fair. My God, the CW. Yeah, so... as you know, everyone, and by you, I'm using the royal you. I don't know what that means. I just wanted to say royal you. Last week, we did not talk about Arrow because of our new schedule, which cuts off on Sunday night. Mm-hmm. And the season premiere of season, what is this, 7 of Arrow.
7 or 8? I don't know.
I think it's 7.
I'll take your word for it.
Yeah, because 5 was Prometheus, right? Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Was it
6? Was, yeah, I think so.
No, wait a minute. Because the Prometheus season, I thought, didn't have the flashbacks. I don't remember.
Arrow season 7.
7. Yeah, we're going to go with 7. No. Yes, 7.
Seven, for God's sake.
Quite frankly.
The season 7 premiere of Arrow came on last Monday, and we have viewed it, and not too shabby.
No, this was fucking awesome. This was, you know, this was the antithesis of what that Walking Dead comic was. Whereas that was boring and had nothing going for it, and you were a bad person if you liked it, this was awesome and had everything going for it, and you're a bad person if you didn't like it.
I didn't like it. It was amazing.
It was.
This is awesome. This kicks us off with the, as you know, at the end of last season, Oliver was sent to prison for the Supermax storyline. Yeah. And this kicks us off with Oliver Queen having been in prison for months now. Star City is vigilante free as the cops are trying to take control of the city again. The FBI is enforcing its no vigilante clause that they made a deal with the heroes at the end of last season. All of our characters from Team Arrow are trying to adjust to their new lives out of costume.
Are they ever?
Felicity Smoke and Young William are in witness protection. And let me just say
that. Are they ever?
Witness protection Felicity is a good Felicity.
You know, she's one of those girls that. Never mind.
You just want to take out on the town,
yep.
Nick?
Yep, that's right.
I know what you mean.
Take her out to a nice dinner and, you know, quite frankly.
And speaking of taking out to a nice dinner, you also get lots of naked Oliver Queen in prison. And
yes. Prison shower Oliver Queen.
Not too shabby, eh?
Prison shower Cody Rhodes as well.
Yes. Prison shower Cody Rhodes fighting prison shower Oliver Queen.
This was awesome. Yeah, you got Vinnie Jones back as Brick. You got Cody Rhodes back as the name of whatever Cody Rhodes' character on Arrow was. And you
Stardust,
got,
right?
I don't fucking know. And then you got Michael Jai White back as Bronze Tiger all in one episode.
Oh my God, yeah.
That's freaking great. I loved it so much. I mean,
Sniveling little whiny-ass prisoner.
Oh my God, that guy. That's the only negative part of the episode where I just wanted Bronze Tiger to put his fist through his throat. Or somebody to do something, shut that little guy up.
He deserved to get the shit beat out of him. My favorite part is when he begs Oliver to save him, and you keep thinking, based on every cliche of a superhero show, that he will, and instead Oliver just walks away. Lets him get beaten mercilessly.
And then we have to get his buttering, crying freak out later.
I thought you were a hero, Oliver!
God. Just the worst. That was the only thing about the episode that didn't work, but like... And they are serving me a giant plate of red meat, because what has this season got more than anything else thus far through one episode? Everyone is miserable, and it is wonderful. I love it.
And how about the scene at the end of the episode? I don't want to spoil it for anyone, but there is a scene at the end of the episode where Oliver finally just loses his shit, and it's awesome.
I thought you're talking about the scene at the end of the episode. One that sets up the new dynamic for the show. I don't want to say exactly what it is yet because they don't explicitly say what these scenes are until the end. You don't get that picture, but like this show, the new formula for the show, and I am 100% on board. It's
awesome. Yeah. It's such a great inversion of the old formula,
right?
That on paper you might not think would work, but in execution works excellently.
Right, because you're trying to figure out what the hell is going on, what the connection of that is to this season, where it's going. Like, is it?
And it's such a staggering, like, surprise scene with some of the characters involved that you're thinking, how could possibly get to this point?
Right. Yes. It's. I loved everything about this episode. Even the wild dog of it all wasn't too bad.
Totally.
Did Curtis appear one time in this episode, by the way?
One time he appeared because he's working at Argus now, so he shows up to help them.
And that was it.
And then the side characters we mainly spend time with are Dinah and Wild Dog.
And Felicity.
Renee.
Obviously.
And Felicity, obviously. But yeah, Renee was really good in this episode. And again, the characters in this episode are nuanced. Mm-hmm. There's no defined right and wrong for what's going on. And it's so much more intriguing than what we get on the bad seasons of The Walking Dead, or the comic book The Walking Dead.
I think we would be doing our audience a disservice, Greg, if we didn't touch on one other thing from the episode. So part of the plot of this episode, as Greg said, is that there's this anti-vigilante truce they've come to, where all the vigilantes from last season have agreed not to perform as vigilantes anymore. And yet, something's going on out there in Star City, Greg, because there's a man running around in a green hood.
There is.
Taking people down with arrows.
He's wearing a hood. He worked for Watts for a while, apparently. And he's back, and he's taking out criminal elements. And we don't know who he is, or she. We don't know who he or she is, and this is the time of the Hard Traveling Fanboys. Every year, there is a mystery on Arrow, and I am legally obligated by our traveling contract to ask my cohort, serve it up on a tee for you. Nick, do you have any theories about who this mystery Green Arrow might be?
I'm at a loss on this one. I got no... I have no idea, really. But, I'm just saying, can we definitively rule out the possibility that it might not be Tommy Merlin?
And there you have it, folks. The first time this season that there is a mystery on a DCCW show where Nick Duke will predict Tommy Merlin as the reveal behind the character.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So,
no shame.
Let's keep an eye on how this develops. Well, nonetheless, that wasn't the only, although it could have been, it wasn't the only CWDC show last week, because we also
got... It might as well have been. Not to say anything bad of the shows, but come on.
It really, yeah.
Come on, man.
So the Flash had an episode as well, and this was an episode in which we learned more about the new villain Cicada, played by the world's greatest living actor, Chris Klein.
I love the Flash. I love it. You know that.
Mm.
I have concerns. I'll put it that way, because he's pretty much just doing the Chris Klein thing thus far. Like, doing his stupid stare into the camera with his vacant eyes, brain-dead expression. I have nothing for it, dude. I don't care.
I keep waiting for him to sing, what was that song he sings in American Pie? Whatever.
How sweet it is?
Yes. Something like that. Nonetheless, I keep waiting for that. But no, this really dealt a lot with Barry and Thor getting to know each other, dealing with the revelations of the last episode, and going around kind of having fun as father and daughter speedsters. Barry trying to deal with parenthood for the first time. He doesn't understand why she won't listen to him, why she doesn't do things the way that he wants her to do them. And he goes and he confides in Joe and complains to him in a great scene, where Joe's response is, "Yeah, welcome to kids." and really just a you know, Joe's stuff is outstanding here. And there's not a whole lot of plot development per se here. It's primarily about building the relationships, the new status quo of the show. And we do get a little bit with Caitlin finding out that her dad, his death certificate was forged by her mom. We get a little bit here with Ralph getting more agency, certainly, than he had in the first episode, including some great lines with him and Cisco, and some unexpected poignancy even from his list. So even with the cicada element there of Chris Klein, I thought this was a really strong episode. The ensemble cast of The Flash is pretty much untouchable for how good they are together.
Yeah, it was a good episode. The villain wasn't the greatest thing in the world, but we got through that. You know, sometimes you can't. They can't all be winners, but all the other dynamics, as you said, they pretty much worked. So, yeah, solid episode.
Absolutely. Black Lightning. Also, there was saw a superhero, and his name was Black Lightning, and. Had another
episode. Saw a superhero last night and he was black. He said, "This is for the streets. Black Lightning's back."
Indeed, Black Lightning was back with its second episode of the second season. And this was one that tackled a couple of pretty big issues on the show. We get a lot more of Tobias Hoyle in this one, of what his new agenda is. And we also get the proliferation of Bill Duke, Nick.
Yes.
A.K.A. Mac from Predator, and of course, Cook from Commando.
Yes.
Which I would argue is his most iconic role, of course. The great Bill Duke, as I'll call him, is in this episode playing a government agent who is clearly nefarious in nature.
Well, he was in the first episode, too.
Yes. But he gets a bigger role here, yes. Seemingly. He's getting into Lynn's ear a little bit and kind of directing her along the way. I have an interesting question about Lynn that I'm going to pose to you in a moment. Or maybe not interesting. Maybe interesting. But, you know, and meanwhile, we're seeing a kind of, I'll be honest, a storyline that kind of felt like it came out of nowhere involving Thunder starting to crave attention.
Mm-hmm.
Become something of a celebrity and love that attention. Not the best storyline. Just kind of didn't feel like I didn't feel like it was hinted at in previous episodes. Maybe it was. And then of course Jennifer still struggling with her powers and a new character that busts one of the pod people bust out and Lynn takes one of them with her home. The other one breaks free and becomes kind of the off-screen villain of the piece, so to speak.
And let's not forget the new tick subplot that pops up.
Not bad,
decent, not too
not a bad story.
Not too shabby,
not a bad story at all. And
character development.
Although they are kind of making Anissa, making Anissa feel a little self-absorbed. So to speak.
Yeah, it is a bit odd, that aspect of it, but...
But I guess it's good to have characters with flaws, too.
Yeah,
so,
there you go.
There's good, interesting dynamics across the board here. There's a great subplot involving Jefferson resigning from the school board and being replaced by a white...
A white man.
And
principal, white principal.
Not right, that's right, not superintendent, principal, because he talks with the superintendent about all this. And so it's... It continues to be a show that pulls no punches. Mm-hmm. They don't run from anything.
Mm-hmm.
They tackle the political subtext much better than some of the competitive shows do. I will say this felt like a little bit of a step back from the premiere for me, just because I wasn't as interested in some of the aspects.
I would agree with that.
But again, still a good episode. Jefferson's the key to the episode, and it's working out. What were your thoughts on the episode, and then I'll pose my question.
I liked it. Like you said, a little bit of a step back from the premiere. They're going to have to find a way. I mean, obviously, they don't want to go the full-on villain of the week format,
right,
the way that Arrow and Flash do. I get that. They want to separate themselves. But you still got to give Black Lightning, that aspect of Jefferson, something compelling to do each week. And I feel like this week, there was barely any Black Lightning in the episode, you know, which is fine. You can have episodes like that. I just don't want that to become a trend for the entire season where they are artificially stretching out the Tobias thing, because that's clearly where we've got to get to, is the big, you know, final confrontation between those two characters. So we'll see how that goes. But, you know, all things considered, a fine episode.
Yes, I do love the intros to these episodes now for this season. Really stylish, cool stuff. Mm-hmm. And the soundtrack's great, the music's great. But here's my question for you. We'll see how this plays out in future episodes, but did it feel to you a little bit like they may have been setting the seeds? And maybe, again, this is the wrestling of me looking into things too much, but did it feel like perhaps they were sowing the seeds a bit for Lynn to break bad a little bit over the course of this season?
I didn't see that.
The reason I bring it up is it felt like they were lingering at times on shots of her looking on at the pod patients with almost a scientific fascination as opposed to a humanistic empathy. Maybe I'm looking too much into it, but there were a couple of times, particularly towards the end of the episode, when Bill Duke's character remarks about using some of these people, and she doesn't really speak up. And then there's the scene at the end when she's looking in at the pod, and it almost felt to me like she's starting to be more scientifically curious than she is empathetic. But I don't know if that maybe that's just me looking too much into it.
No, interesting. It's interesting. Interesting to hear that. I'll have to look for that going forward.
We'll see. Could be nothing. But with that being said, Supergirl. We also had the second episode of Supergirl as we continue the Mercy and Otis Graves subplot. This time they take on Mercy face to face as she causes the technology that allows aliens to masquerade as humans to malfunction, which leads to Brainiac 5 having a conflict with his local pizza man. And pretty much the entire episode revolves around that and a philosophical difference between Kara and – or was that in the first episode? That was in the first episode where Kara and John have the philosophical difference. Never mind.
This is now – you know, the president has been revealed to be an alien, so you have – the country is going through a bit of a crisis where divisiveness is starting to seep in over this issue. Right-wing extremist groups are popping up that are – violently anti-alien, the villainous forces of the Graves siblings, as well as this new character, Agent of Liberty, I believe, are all stoking those fires. And along the way, you've got Kara trying to get Lena to help, while Lena also has these issues with Supergirl, and Kara is doing a terrible job at this point of hiding her identity as Supergirl from Lena. Unless Lena is a mental invalid, she now knows that Kara is Supergirl, in my view.
Right, there's just no way. Right. I mean, it's becoming too apparent. And it was a fun sequence where Kara kept trying to come up with excuses to get away, and Lena kept saying, "No, you're safer with me." And I thought that was a pretty entertaining sequence as she kept looking for any excuse to get out of there. I wonder where the Tessmacher stuff is going. It feels like that's going somewhere where she had this secret hidden skill that she's a, you know, expert, I guess, locksmith or something. But obviously the growing relationship of Alex and Brainiac 5 trying to become friends and stuff. All that stuff was good and fine. The look of the – I don't know anything about Agent of Liberty as a character, but except that it is a character from the comics. But the look of Agent of Liberty seems a little bit to be inspired, at least the mask, from the voice of Rao from Krypton, which I know you haven't seen, which is interesting because it's a good look. And so, you know, I thought they did a good job with that. The only problem with this episode, Nick, ultimately, is – I did not like any of the stuff that took place at Catco.
I didn't have a problem with it. Listen, damn it. the show, none of these CW shows often excel at subtlety. So let's get that on the table.
That's true.
And so I guess my bar for Supergirl has been set at the snapper car level. And when you are able to exceed that, it doesn't irk me. It passes my sniff test. So, like, while I agree these things were not subtly handled at all and could have been done a lot better, the things that they were writing and the things they were saying had a point and had a purpose and made a level of sense. So I ultimately, did I love it? No, but I don't think I came down on it as hard as you did.
Where is Snapper Carr, by the way? Have we talked about that?
He's on sabbatical.
Ah.
He's been on sabbatical for 2 years now.
As you know, newspapers are fond of when their reporters go on sabbatical.
Just leave for an extended period of time. But when you're a grizzled young journo like Snapper, you're allowed to do that.
Yeah, I guess my big issue with it was the philosophical debate between James and the new reporter, Nia.
Right.
Not because of the content necessarily or the overall idea they were driving at in the episode, which is clearly that, you know, wrong was being done, somebody needed to call out this wrong for being done. But from a journalistic standpoint and from a I guess I'm particularly sensitive about it given recent online discussions about journalism in the world of Daredevil on Netflix, that, you know, the idea of a reporter going in and essentially guilt-tripping their boss into writing an editorial, it just doesn't happen, at least in any experience that I've ever
had. Yeah, but Greg, I mean, like, if they portrayed it realistically, these people would all be like,
that's true.
You know, eating
miserable,
eating beanie weenies and getting paid $9 an hour. Like, what?
It would be boring, no doubt. Know. They'd be covering city council meetings, no doubt. It was just like, I don't know. It struck me as ham-handed,
I agree that, like, her coming to him and trying to force him to do it was a little weird and unrealistic. But I actually, God help me for saying this.
Say it.
James Olsen had something of a point, though. He's like, hey, man, it's not that I disagree with you. It's that you have to understand that if we take an editorial stance, people are just going to dismiss us out of hand because that's the climate we live in. And I was like, hey, that's actually that's a solid point. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I agree.
So I guess that's where I'll come down on it. This new character of Nia, I don't, you know, we'll see where she goes. But the whole plot didn't bother me the same way.
Yeah, it wasn't so much, I guess, the subplot. It was just the particular dialogue in some of the scenes. Because I feel like Supergirl, of all the shows, struggles the most at this. Because Supergirl is a show that takes itself a little bit more seriously at times in terms of its messages. Arrow does too. Arrow, I think, tends to tackle things, I think, from a little bit more of a nuanced perspective in terms of socio-political issues. Mm-hmm. Supergirl is very on the nose. And when you're on the nose and good, it's okay. But I think at times this one teetered for me. But still, I agree with you. It wasn't that bad. And and James Olsen actually did have a point here. So overall, another solid episode of Supergirl. And the DCCW show's rolling, man. They're not a bad episode among them.
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree with
that.
So
let's go ahead and rank them then.
Okay, you go ahead.
Well, at the top, I mean, there's no question at the top I've got Arrow by a wide margin. Number two, I would have The Flash this week. Number three, I would have Black Lightning. And number four, I would have Supergirl.
I would go Arrow 1, I would go Flash 2, Supergirl 3, and Black Lightning 4.
Very good. So, do we want to delve onto the big screen, or do we want to stick on TV and let me talk about Walking Dead and Titans?
Yeah, let's stick with Walking Dead and Titans.
Alright, so I will start us off by talking about Friday night and the second episode of Titans, which I happened to catch over the weekend at some point. Undistinguished point in time. Sunday night, actually. I watched it alongside the illustrious host of Sunday Groove, David Sunday. Check out his podcast here at PlaceToBeNation.com. We watched Titans Episode 2, and damn it, I liked it more than the premiere, Nick.
Interesting.
I don't know how to quite feel about this, because I've rarely been as certain that a show was going to suck. It's the opposite of the Gotham effect, where I have rarely been as certain that a show was not going to suck. I was going into Gotham and then was proven wrong. Now, I was not so certain that a show would suck as I was going into this, and I've so far been proven wrong, because I thought that in almost every regard this was even a step up from the premiere. It was an episode that took a bold choice of focusing on two non-main characters, Hawk and Dove, as the primary point of view characters for much of the episode, and it worked. It absolutely worked. I have never given, full disclosure, I've never given a single crap about Hawk and Dove, who are longtime DC Comics characters, I believe Steve Ditko creations, if I'm not mistaken. I could be mistaken pretty much so on that. That's how little I know about Hawk and Dove. But I ever cared about them at all. They were created by Steve Ditko. Whether it be in the comics, even the cartoon, Nick, you know how much I love Justice League and Justice League Unlimited. Even Justice League Unlimited couldn't make me care about Hawk and Dove. Titans does in one episode. They come out with an opening scene that reminded me of Kick-Ass, the movie. The very similar scene in that movie involving Big Daddy in a torture scene. It really instantly sucked me in, even though it was derivative, admittedly, but it sucked me in and it made me care about these characters. There's an interesting backstory with already building Dick Grayson as the Lothario that he is in the comics, as he has a sexual back history with Dove that they delve into a little bit on here. And continuing to be the MVP of the show is Raven. I don't have her name in front of me, but the girl that is playing Raven on this show is absolutely the MVP so far. She is great. She is a really, really great young actress, and is doing a good job on the show of making Raven a character that we as an audience care about and want to see protected and served by the people around her, even though they're letting their own egos and their own conflicts get in the way. We also get our first sort of appearance of Alfred over the phone as he talks to Dick. You just hear him as kind of a faint voice over the phone, but it's distinctly British and it's distinctly Alfred trying to talk Master Grayson into patching things up, perhaps. So, it was a really good episode. There are still some issues. I still think that some of the violence is gratuitous. There's a scene where Robin throws one of his, I don't know what you'd call them, Robin rings at a criminal, hits him in the eyeball, and then pulls it slowly out of his eyeball.
God, really?
Which is, yeah. So, which causes the man a great deal of pain, as you might imagine, Nick.
Yeah, but I mean,
and you know, it feels a bit much. The angle that they're going with is that Batman has gone exceedingly violent and that Dick has found himself going exceedingly violent. Because even Dove comments that he's going much farther than he ever has before. And he's clearly one of them self-hating superheroes. I'm with you, Nick. That fit much to me. The fight scenes are good. The fight scenes are very good, in fact, on here. But some of the violence coming from Dick Grayson feels a bit much. That was it. And then this was certainly an episode where they were flaunting, to use the word fuck, because it's all over the place in this episode from Hawk. Mm-hmm. But overall, really enjoyed the damn episode. And they introduced a new set of villains called the Nuclear Family that apparently are from the comics, but I've never heard of in my life. Had to Google them. And they were creepy as hell on here and led to a genuinely shocking ending of the episode. So I know that you're probably going to be slow to catch up to it and everything, but for all my – and I'm not 100% on board yet because, like I said, I think the violence is a bit much for what it should be at this point, even beyond what the Netflix shows are, in my opinion, outside of Punisher. But I'm on board for the story. I'm into it, man.
Right. And let me reiterate here, having not seen the episode, my issue is not with violence. My issue is with – does this level of violence fit these characters? That is what I continue to question. It fits something like a grounded street level dark approach to Daredevil. It fits the Punisher, obviously. Does it fit Dick Grayson and Starfire and Beast Boy, you know, like...
Who don't even appear in this episode.
Right.
Starfire and Beast Boy are for some reason, not in this, but it actually works to the show's benefit because
more
the
focused,
story
maybe.
That they're telling, it's more focused, right. and the story that they're telling is genuinely compelling, mm-hmm. because damn if I don't want to find out more about Raven and her background and why these weirdos are after her.
Well, cool.
So, yeah, good stuff. Now, right after that, we watched live the third episode of The Walking Dead. And while it wasn't quite as strong as last week's episode, which, as I mentioned, was one of the best in a long time of The Walking Dead, like up there with, you know, the good seasons, it was another really, really good episode, and again, was better than the premiere. This was primarily an episode revolving around... Let me see if I can remember exactly what happened in it. Yes, so the tenuous alliance that Rick, if you might remember from the premiere, that Rick has been trying to forge between these different groups in order to build this bridge, it's finally starting to collapse. Already starting to collapse because the Saviors have not been 100% on board from the get-go. Half of them don't want anything to do with any of these people. They still want to act like jerks. And last episode, it ended with one of the Saviors being killed by a mystery assailant. And this was a guy that had already fist fought with Daryl earlier in the episode, who had cussed out Carol, who had threatened Rick. There was a lot of suspects of who it could have been. Well, they resolve it in this episode, but they do it in a really, really nuanced, subtle, compelling fashion here as we get a – Rick is trying his best to keep everybody together, to keep everybody united. But now the Savior is no longer the rest of them because they think that they're being picked off. And Rick instituted a policy along with everyone else that the Saviors can't have any guns on them for good reason. Now the Saviors want guns on them if they're going to continue this bridge project. And it just creates this giant conflict, and Rick is kind of at the end of his rope trying to figure out how to – make everybody see that his way is the right way. And characters in this episode just flat out tell him that he's full of garbage and they're not interested in his way, that his way is stupid. Daryl tells him his way is stupid. And he's like, you don't understand, Rick. None of us wanted it this way. We don't need the Saviors. You know, that they would be pissing on our graves right now if they had the opportunity. And, you know, Carol even comes and tries to talk sense into him. So, and to their credit, they're showing a Rick that is struggling with this. He's not just blindly set in one set of circumstances. And it's a great episode with a really great ending. The way they reveal the mystery was compelling and satisfying. And then it leads to Maggie and Daryl making a decision that I suspect the viewing audience 100% agrees with. Or perhaps I should say 87%, because I watched a little bit of the Talking Dead show after, and they did an audience poll of did you agree with Maggie and Daryl's decision, and 87% of the audience did. And I don't know this for a fact, Nick, but I would suspect that the as they were crafting it, that was not the desired effect.
What was their decision?
So it turns out that the person that has been abducting Saviors and killing them is the girl who was the leader of Oceanside, whose okay. grandmother was killed and all that.
Right, right.
She and her group of Oceanside survivors have been kidnapping Saviors one by one, individual, not all the Saviors, but individual Saviors, and executing them.
Okay.
Because it's the ones that burned down their settlement.
And killed all the men.
Killed all the men, all yep. their brothers, their fathers, right. their sons.
Right.
And they find her after they have abducted the short-haired Savior woman from last season.
Yes.
I forget her name. She's a weird name. They all have weird names.
It's fine. It's fine.
They've abducted her, and they're in the wilderness, and Daryl and Maggie show up, and they tell him, you can't do that. You can't just – you know, that's not how it is now. We're not going to execute people as they're about to execute her. And so the girl who's the leader of Oceanside tearfully explains exactly what happened and how this individual person – executed her brother right in front of her eyes and smiled about it. And she makes her tell Daryl and Maggie what she said that night. And she doesn't want, she says, I don't remember, it's been so long. And then she's like, say it, tell them. And Daryl says, what did you say? And finally she says, I said no exceptions. And then Daryl and Maggie look at each other and they look back at the scene and they look back at each other again and they kind of just nod and they turn their backs and they walk away. And then you see the savior get shot in the head with an arrow from the OJ girl.
Cool. I'm down with it.
Yes. It was great. It was very well done. It made sense. And they end of the end of the episode is Maggie telling Daryl, it's time for us to go see Negan. We tried Rick. So the big conflict is coming.
Okay, cool.
Good stuff. And that's that. Now, Nick, let's move on to the big screen because both of us have now had a chance to view the Tom Hardy vehicle known as Venom.
Venom, yes. Not Vic Venom, but Venom.
Not Vic Venom, bro, but Venom. A movie that, in full disclosure, we're very against for a long time.
Yeah, we low expectations coming into this one, I'll put it that way.
Extremely low expectations.
Positive word of mouth from people who we had talked to who had actually seen it, coupled with even the reviews that were mostly negative, had some thing there they praised, you know.
And even some of the things that they criticized were things that made me think, hey, I might actually enjoy that aspect.
Right, right. And so, like, you know, I had an opportunity because I've been off this week for some little vacation time. So I figured, what the hell? We'll give it a shot. So I went to the theater.
And you watched it.
I watched it, yep.
It was
all right. Like,
yeah. I mean, here's the thing. It's a movie that, like, it feels, I agree with what I've heard from some other people that I've talked to about it, that it does feel like a comic book movie that was made before 2008, if that makes sense.
Sure, yeah.
In terms of the structure, the plot, the, you know, some of the effects, some of the things like that.
But you're not really here for the plot. Like, the thing
not.
Like, and I say this as someone who is, Greg knows this about me, normally I'm a sucker for an origin story. I am typically into this whole, like, watching the hero become the hero thing, like, seeing how it all unfolds. The first half hour of this movie, Greg, is a slog, dude. Like, I was sitting there waiting for, like, trying to find the positives that you had told me about, because you saw it before I did. And I was like, man, I don't know that these positives are coming. And then once the symbiote actually shows up, the movie's fairly entertaining from then on out.
Yeah, it is. It definitely is. Man, I was, like, blown away by how much I enjoyed every involving Venom.
Yeah.
The breastular character Venom. Because this movie, I told you this before you saw it. If this movie had, if you took Tom Hardy out of this movie, it's terrible.
It's awful. It's unwatchable. Yeah.
Yes, it's unwatchably bad. But Tom Hardy in this movie is fantastic.
Yes.
I
still don't know what the hell that accent is, but I don't care.
But it's perfect for this movie.
Yes.
Like, it's like, I said this in the chat the other night that we're in, that I think Tom Hardy right now, I came to this realization, I was talking it over also at work with my boss, and we were like, Tom Hardy might be the best actor consistency wise going right now that's not an old man.
Right,
because it doesn't matter what the role is, it doesn't matter what the movie is,
right,
he is going to do exactly what is right for that role. If it's a role that requires nuance,
right,
and subtlety,
right,
he can do that. If it's a role that requires stoicism, he can do that. Or in this case, it was a role that this, I can't
you
imagine
go,
you look at the script,
you had to go big.
Yeah, you had to go big. You had to have manic energy. And there's a scene involving him at the restaurant that it is a freaking tour de force of acting. It's fantastic.
Apparently, like, I read somewhere they booked this restaurant, you know, for this on-location shoot, and Tom Hardy walked in and, like, insisted that the lobster tank bit be added to the scene.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Because it helped make the movie.
Yeah.
It's one of the best scenes in the entire movie, and if not the, it's certainly up there. And so the entire – and it's not – and while I would say 75 to 80% of this movie's success owes to Tom Hardy because of how good he is. Also credit to whoever wrote and delivered the Venom lines.
I think Tom Hardy delivered the Venom lines.
Well, then that's more to Tom Hardy and whoever wrote – because the way that they write and the way they script Venom here and his relationship with Eddie Brock is a little bit unlike what I've read before in the comics from when I was a kid, but so good. So freaking funny. There were some some genuine laugh-out-loud moments in this movie.
Tom Hardy does the voice of Venom through some sort of – technical manipulation. Yes.
I don't want to spoil some of the best lines in the movie.
Oh my god!
But pussy. Is one of them. There is
you're a loser, Eddie.
You are a loser. Well, I was a loser too. That was a great callback too that I wasn't expecting. Yes. In a movie like Venom, you're not expecting actual callbacks to earlier in the film,
right?
And they had a nice one there. I thought they actually did a decent job of explaining, or not explaining, but of making you believe that Venom was growing on Eddie a little bit,
right?
It was awesome.
Yeah,
the entire
appeal, what is here that is watchable? Like, because again, let me just reiterate. The plot, like actual like character movements and stuff, I couldn't have cared less about. The villain is terrible. The love interest is thin as hell, although I think Michelle Williams does a decent enough job in the movie. But her character written thinly as hell.
Yeah. Much like a lot of love interests in superhero movies.
The Jenny Slate doctor character is borderline. God, she was insufferable to me. I just wanted her to
really
go
bad,
away.
Yeah.
There's nobody in this movie outside of Tom Hardy, and like I said, with the possible exception of Michelle Williams, that has any business being on screen for any amount of time because you just don't care. But that's a testament to how good the Tom Hardy or the Eddie Brock Venom dynamic is, that dynamic alone carries you through the entire, like, not the entire movie, because the first 30 minutes, like I said, doesn't have it. The back hour of the movie is carried entirely by this one dynamic. Because really, even like action-wise, there's only one good action scene in the movie.
Yes.
And it's the chase sequence.
Yep.
The closing fight is bad. It's outright bad. Like, it suffers from that Michael Bay syndrome that he has in the Terminator movies, where the two things that were fighting were so visually similar.
They were so similar, you couldn't tell apart.
You couldn't dislocate one from the other. And you didn't care either. Like, you didn't actually care if this rocket ship guy. I mean,
no, I just wanted Venom and Eddie to stay together.
Right. That's all we cared about.
I want a movie with no fighting in it. I want Venom and Eddie just living in an apartment in San Francisco and trying to make their ends meet.
Well, you gotta get Michelle Williams in there to make ends meet. You know what I mean? Like, because clearly in this movie, there's got to be some kind of weird, fucked up threesome sex scene coming in the sequel.
Well, like, there is the scene. I don't want to spoil it for anyone that hasn't seen it, but Michelle does get a little hands on with Venom.
She does. And okay, we got it. I can't not. Okay, this is a movie that, like I said, it's very flawed, but it has this awesome dynamic. But what I can say about this is there are so many lessons that people who made this can easily learn from this. Like, identify the things that work and identify the things that didn't. I actually am very excited for the sequel at this point.
Me too.
Like, I feel like there's an opportunity here to drastically improve upon what you had here. And a large portion of that is because, and I'm sorry, we're going to put a spoiler thing right here. Spoilers. Because in 5 seconds, we're about to talk about the damn post-credit scene. All right, here we go. Post-credit scene now. Jesus Christ, give me Woody Harrelson in that goofy-ass Cletus Cassidy wig for 2 hours. Just going on about nonsense in his southern accent. I am for it. I am 100% for it.
What makes me feel like the makers of this movie get it is that last shot of him where he literally, he looks at the camera and it zooms in on his face and he says, "It's going to be carnage."
Great! And the wig, the wig has to be seen to be believed. It looks like they went in a time machine back to 1993 and went to your local costume shop and bought a carrot top wig and brought it back to 2018 and just stuck it on Woody Harrelson and went, "Good enough."
And there's a moment where if the scene flashes back and forth of their conversation between Hardy and Woody Harrelson. And there's a moment where I'm choosing to believe that it's not Eddie Brock, but it's Tom Hardy seeing Woody Harrelson's over-the-top performance and saying, "That's a challenge. I'm going to outdo you."
Yes.
I want it so bad. I do. And it should be good. One other thing I want to talk about this while we're in spoiler territory. Right. Speaking of, I can't let this go by since we were talking about, we had the discussion about journalism on Supergirl, and I know there's articles about it on Daredevil, but Tom Hardy's Eddie Brock in this movie. Eddie Brock makes the decision to give up, willingly walk away from a lucrative TV job.
Yes.
So that he can dedicate himself to printed work.
Folks, for those of you who've never worked in journalism, that's the most ludicrous fucking thing anyone's ever said.
Have you ever noticed that people that are old, long-time writers end up on TV? Do you know why that is? Because your goal is not to gossip.
And also,
you can't survive.
Eddie Brock is not a very good journalist in this movie. Let's not gloss over that. As a matter of fact, I think one of my favorite lines in the movie, not one of, my favorite line in the movie that isn't delivered by either Tom Hardy or Eddie Brock is when his boss tells him, Eddie, to be such a smart guy, you're kind of a dumbass. Yes. And I was like, yeah.
His boss is really good, actually, which is it's that guy from Luke Cage.
Luke Cage, it is.
Yeah, he was great.
Ray Mathy, I think is his name.
Yeah, he was great as the boss.
Oh, and I guess one other thing we should touch on, just because, I mean, with post-credit stuff, there are two – there's one post-credit scene and then a post-credit teaser for Into the Spider-Verse that's coming out in December. We actually get kind of an extended scene from that movie that was awesome.
And it looks like, good. Much to my surprise, it looks like they're going with the idea, which is different from what I thought. They're being comic book accurate, it seems, because it seems like there was a Peter Parker in Miles.
You have no idea how much joy that gave me to see.
I thought of you when I saw it.
The 1991 to 2018 gravestone or headstone, implying that Peter, you know, died when he was 17, much like he did in the Ultimate. I mean, virtually similarly to the way he did in the Ultimate Universe. But not just that, the comedy in it actually really worked. And, you know, I'm usually really hard on movies, you know.
I'm aware.
And this was funny. Like, this was legitimately funny, this scene where he's like, Miles is trying to help a passed out Peter Parker swing away from the cops. And one other thing that I was blown away by is we've seen a little bit of it in the trailers and stuff. As critical as I was of that animation style to begin with, I kind of love it now. Like, the movements of these characters look like it looks like a comic book panel, and not in that cheesy, bad, like Ang Lee Hulk kind of way where he keeps trying to pop up the panels and stuff. Like, there's a lot of this, even the pointillism, when light goes a certain way, you know, it works, man. I'm all for it. My expectations for this movie continue to rise the closer it gets. I can't wait at this point.
Yeah, it was great. It was really entertaining, and I'm excited to see where it all goes. I already have a prediction, by the way. You are going to love it, and I think you're going to be upset because at least one of your kids is not going
to
love it.
Oh, I'm not going to care if my kids love it. That doesn't matter to me. Like, you know. I'm going to love it. That's all that matters, you know.
Then that will be in the era of you force-feeding it to them until they do love it.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, that's the end of a pretty long edition of reading and watching. Mm-hmm. Have you done any playing lately?
No. I downloaded the first bit of DLC for the Spider-Man PS4 game, but I have not had a chance to play that. Hopefully I'll have something to report back for you for next week's episode.
Very good. I am not going to be playing any comic book content because I've messed around and waited, and now it's time for Red Dead Redemption 2, so that will be on my buying agenda.
You've had 3 years to play Arkham Knight and just refused to do it.
Well, there's a time for everything, Nick. To everything, turn. There is a season.
I can't wait for you to buy Red Dead and to just look at it for 3 months.
You know, believe me, I've thought about that possibility, including just now as we've been talking. I've been like, what if I buy it and it just sits there and I don't play it because it's football season? And then I'll be trying. Then January comes and I'm trying to catch up on wrestling for the last several months. It's a possibility, but I'm super excited for the game, so I'm going to buy it anyway. Well, anyway, that's neither here nor there. Look at the time, Nick.
Mm-hmm.
Look at the time on the clock. My goodness gracious, God googly moogly. There is 1 minute on the clock, Nick, and you know what that means.
I don't. Tell me.
Well, I'll tell you. It means that it's time for the Professional Wrestling Minute.
Oh, man.
And all jokes aside, yeah, it's hard to talk about anything in the world of wrestling this week without talking about the only news that matters this week, right, which is the shocking announcement Monday night of Roman Reigns, the WWE Universal Champion, being diagnosed with a recurrence of leukemia.
Leukemia, yeah.
Which we didn't even know that he had in the first place.
As I told Greg, I was not watching Raw Monday night. I was at an Atlanta Falcons football game. And I had been drinking all day, not all day, but for a good 7 hours, pretty heavily. And I was so drunk at the game that, like, I looked at my phone, I checked Twitter at one point, and I saw the words, like, Roman Reigns and leukemia. And I remember being, like, I thinking to myself, I am so drunk that I am inventing tweets that don't exist at this point. I was like, my mind is creating words that aren't there. And so I convinced myself that that was not a real thing. And then it wasn't until, like, much later in the evening as I was driving home that I looked again and I saw it again. I was like, my God, that it was so out of left field because, like you said, yeah, it's a recurrence of leukemia that none of us knew they had in the first place. So it's just exceedingly bizarre. And, you know, I am not... The great Roman Reigns debate of the last 5 years is one of those things where it feels like everybody has this passionate side in it except for me. You know, like, I think the guy's really good in the ring. I think his character sucks most of the time. And ultimately, I just kind of go, he's all right. You know, like, I'm no great fan of the man, but you can't help but feel for him and be pulling for him in a time like this.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we're obviously, I think anybody that is not a blatant troll is your heart goes out to Joe NOI and his family. Roman Reigns going out there and performing for all these years, dealing with what he's dealt with, beating what he's beaten, wife, young children,
right?
Thoughts and prayers out to them, and hopefully he will beat this and come back stronger than ever. Mm-hmm. And so that's pretty much the rest of the minute. There's no point in talking about any of the actual on-screen stuff. We'll talk about his Shield brothers next week and how that whole thing's going. So, with that being said, that's the wrestling minute, folks. So I guess, there's nothing else to talk about this week, Nick. No. Probably time for us to just pack it up.
Well, actually, you know, as I said earlier, I heard Mr. Ross over there warming up a little while ago, and yeah, he's gonna sing us out as he's done the last few weeks. And you know, somebody asked me the other day if Jim Ross was only gonna sing country tunes on this show. And I thought about it.
Oh, yes, that's been a popular question.
It's been a popular question. And I think we need to put that question to bed. We need to go ahead and just end that now. No. Jim Ross is a man of many trades. He is a true Renaissance man, and we're going to prove that here by taking you back to 2005 and a little tune by you may know her, a little girl by the name of Gwen Stefani. So maybe you remember this one, maybe you don't, but I think whether you do or you didn't, there's no question at this point that the Jim Ross version will become the definitive version. Ladies and gentlemen, the Hard Traveling Fanboys present Jim Ross performing Gwen Stefani's Holla Back Girl.
Oh, this my shit! All the girls stamp your feet like this. Few times I've been around that track, so it's not just gonna happen like that. Cause I ain't no holler back girl. No, I ain't no holler back girl. Few times I've been around that track, so it's not just gonna happen like that. Cause I ain't no goddamn holler back girl. I ain't no holler back girl. This is my shit. This is my shit. This my shit. This my shit. This my shit. This my shit. Oh, this my shit. This my shit. We get it. We get it, Francis. Lighten up. I heard that you were talking shit, and you didn't think I would hear it. People hear you talking that, getting everybody fired up. So I'm ready to attack. Gonna lead the pack. Gonna get a touchdown like Baker Mayfield. Gonna take you out. That's right, put your pom-poms down, getting everybody fired up, few times I've been around that track, a few times here and there. Fair, decent mind for this business. Might have worked for a few guys that drew a little bit of money. So it's not just going to happen like that. Because I ain't no hollaback girl. I ain't no hollaback girl. A few times I've been around that track. So it's not just going to happen like that. You know who had a good track record was Shelton Benjamin. Maybe the finest athlete I ever recruited as the head of talent relations at WWE. I ain't no hollaback girl. I ain't no hollaback girl. This my shit. 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 Uh-huh. This my shit. This is my shit. This my shit. That's right, dude. Meet me at the back of bleachers. No principals, no student teachers, no Michonne blowing me in the parking lot. Both of us want to be the winner. There can only be one. There can be one man in this business. If you don't want to be the man in this business, you need to get into a different business. So I'm going to fight. I'm going to give it my all. I'm going to make you fall. I'm going to sock it to you. That's right. I'm the last one standing. And another one bites the dust. A few times I've been around that track. So it's not just going to happen like that. Because I ain't no hollaback girl. I ain't no hollaback girl. A few times I've been around that track. So it's not just going to happen like that. Because I ain't no hollaback girl. I ain't no hollaback girl. You know what? This is my shit. This my shit. This is my shit. This my shit. This my shit. This my shit. Now, let me hear you say, this shit is bananas. B-A-N-A-N-A-S. This shit is bananas. B-A-N-A-N-A-S. Once again, this shit is bananas. B-A-N-A-N-A-S. This shit is bananas. B-A-N-A-N-A-S. Few times I've been around that track, so it's not just going to happen like that. Because I ain't no hollaback girl. I ain't no hollaback girl. Few times I've been around that Casper mattress. So it's not just going to happen like that. Because I ain't no blue chew girl. I ain't no blue chew girl. This my shit. 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 This is my discolored Oklahoma shit. Water, 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 water